You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 256 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
We'll be talking more about the Seahawks offseason later in this pod with Shield Kapadia of The Athletic. But first, let's get to this week's beer because I'm very excited about it. We have here the Trailblazer Pale Ale from Métier Brewing Company, which is a place we've been wanting to check out. Washington's only Black-owned brewery. Métier opened in 2008 and is co-owned by brewer Rodney Hines and business partner. Did I say 2008?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that happens sometimes. And business partner Todd Harriet, who's the co-founder of Métier Racing and Coffee in Capitol Hill. Métier means calling or life's work in French. The Trailblazer Pale Ale features a label by Creative Lou depicting Major Taylor, who won the sprint event at the 1899 World Track Championships, becoming the first Black American to become a cycling world champion. Proceeds from the bottle sales support Cascade Bicycle Club's Major Taylor Project, which empowers youth in underserved neighborhoods through cycling, including Tai High School.
Hello. There we go.
Like I said, so since we first heard about this last spring, been wanting to get there, but it's in Woodinville, so that's a bit of a haul for the Fabulous Pelton Brothers. But in a very exciting development, this month at that was an intriguing idea, at Pagliacci Pizza,
really
our sponsors. Sometimes you misread things. At our sponsors, they are selling the four packs of the Trailblazer Pale Ale. So I picked up a pizza last Thursday, got the Indugia spicy sausage, which was quite delicious, better even than I remembered than last year, and also the four pack of the Métier Trailblazer Pale Ale.
Well, I can always get behind anything called Trailblazer, for sure. but have been excited to drink this for basically a year. We've been talking about getting this beer and making an excursion to Woodinville, but apparently the Pelton brothers do not go to Woodinville.
I can't say that I've been to Woodinville in the past year. That is for certain, or anywhere close.
In the past year? It's been a while.
Yeah.
Well, and again, also amazing for Pagliacci to have this beer at their location. Got to say, the Pagliacci beer selection, affordable and top-notch what they are doing with beer. I got a six-pack of Rogers Pilsner. I think it was $8.
That's incredible. If so,
it was maybe $10, but from a third party seller, it was incredible to have. And now having Métier, which you're not seeing in almost any other location, right? You're not seeing it in the brew houses and places like that. Having this, Pagliacci just knows what they're doing.
100%, and that's the Matador Primo that has the spicy sausage as well as Castelvetrano olives. So quite good. Definitely recommended. Is there seasonal? All right. Well, we got several toasts to get to as usual, starting with a congratulations to Daniel Sally on winning our men's tournament challenge bracket with Baylor's win earlier tonight over previously undefeated Gonzaga.
There we go.
Do you want to expound on falling to the ground in shock after Jalen Suggs banked three-pointer in overtime to secure Gonzaga's win over UCLA in the semifinals?
Is this when we're talking about Gonzaga? We're doing it now?
Yeah, I mean, when else are we going to do it?
So I think for me, it was more about cheering for UCLA than it was about cheering against Gonzaga and then cheering for the Pac-12. I feel like my ranking of preference for college basketball especially is like UW, then all of the Pac-12, right? But especially the Southern California schools, I feel like, and Oregon State.
Really?
And then this is me as somebody who dreams of living in Southern California, dreams of quitting this podcast completely and just being in the sunshine. Instead of planning day trips to freezing cold Portland or whatever, Palm Springs. But so that's my
not as good food in Palm Springs.
And then it's all of the rest of the Pac-12 after that. Oregon at the bottom, Wazoo right above them.
I feel like I have Wazoo much higher. within above. The Pac-12.
Yeah, they might be ahead of the Arizona schools. Who knows? But but so that's my rooting interest in sports. Gonzaga's kind of just another school to me, right? I don't really have any strong positive or negative feelings. However, if there are certain people who've achieved, you know, we have the Pelton Cast Hall of Fame. These are people who kind of naturally achieved Pelton Cast sainthood, right? And I would say people over time, he hasn't been elected to the Hall of Fame yet. We'll see. Maybe this is the year. Coach Sark, somehow that happened. I don't know what happened. And from the same time period as Coach Sark, that is Lorenzo Romar, wrongfully terminated by the University of Washington. And nobody who wrongs Lorenzo Romar can be right in my book. And that's what Mark Few did by reporting recruiting violations against Lorenzo Romar. And yes, we do not forget about this. So that is why there could be any negativity toward Gonzaga, right? Otherwise, it is complete ambivalence to the program. But you cross Lorenzo Romar and you cross me. So, but otherwise, I honestly don't understand, aside from proximity, what the rooting interest for Gonzaga would be, which proximity is a very strong factor. Don't get me wrong, but
I think it's pretty the primary factor.
Part of the reason that you care about professional sports is you get to know the players and you love them as people, right? You feel like they reflect you. When you, University of Washington, there are players who are committing there and I'm like, oh shit, that's Mrs. Fantasy Genius's high school that these players went to. They feel like they're part of your community, right? Like these are people who represent you. Gonzaga has one player from all of Washington State on the team, right? They don't really reflect the community in Washington, Seattle in particular, and especially in Spokane, right?
This is sort of like how UW men's basketball represents upstate New York.
Exactly. Nashua, look, as a citizen of that community. No, I think that's part of why we don't feel as connected to this UW team though, right? Like, I think you're kind of getting to the heart of the issue, which is if there were a bunch of players from Seattle and they were, I mean, this is why we're fucking pissed off. What's the dude's name from Wazoo? Who's yelling, "This is my house" at UW? And no, you're like, no, it kind of is. Yeah. Right? You're like, you have a point, dude. You know?
So, I don't know if you're aware of this. I think people are more concerned about the fact that they're losing a bunch of games than the fact that they're losing it with people
It would feel different if it was a bunch of players.
Is they did bring back many Western Washington players this year.
You understand what I'm saying, though, right? Like that is part of why you cheer for college sports regionally. If you didn't attend that school, I didn't go to Gonzaga, and they have nothing that reflects me on their team. If there were a bunch of really good players from Seattle, I would A, be mad that those players didn't commit to UW, and B, probably feel something about them. Even the players from the Seattle area that didn't commit to UW, I feel generally positive about, right?
I suppose so.
So especially over time. Now, Jalen Suggs, on the other hand, I have to say, after watching these games, I'm a Jalen Suggs fan.
Of course. He's I told the entire you
team,
would be. Though.
I'm sorry, but like you were like, Gonzaga is the most exciting team to watch in college basketball, and that's an incorrect statement. Jalen Suggs is the most exciting player to watch in college basketball. He is that team. And maybe it's just because I've seen two Gonzaga games all year, but it was okay.
Thanks for your insight.
Everybody else is just role players around Jalen Suggs. What he does, especially tonight in the national championship game, it was him and a bunch of nobodies out there.
It was an atypical performance by Gonzaga. I think very much to the credit of Baylor, their pressure defense caused a lot of problems. And offensively, they were incredibly sharp with their shot making and their ability to take care of the basketball had a huge advantage in terms of shot volume. I mean, Gonzaga was so good over the course of the season that even after playing this close game against an 11 seed in UCLA and losing comfortably to Baylor, I still think it's quite possible that they were the best team NCAA team of the 2000s. This is just sort of the nature of single game
hang the banner
competition.
Ken Palm champions.
Well, look, are you gonna make fun of someone else for hanging the statistical champion banner? That's a little on our brand as Seahawks fans. But Baylor was the number two team clearly, before they had their COVID pause in late February, and they played like that team throughout the NCAA tournament and, you know, just had an awesome performance in the championship game.
Okay, so you were telling me that I was going to be convinced that I would love Jalen Suggs after watching him. Why is that?
Because he reminds me of Brandon Roy. I mean, they're not exactly the same player. He doesn't play at as controlled and deliberate a pace as Brandon Roy did, because as you pointed out, no one has played at that same pace as Brandon Roy, but there are elements of it, certainly.
I don't know if no one plays at as controlled of a pace as Brandon Roy, which it is funny that I think he fouled out in his last game for UW, which is kind of absurd, but, or at least was in foul trouble.
No, he did double tech. Yeah.
But no one is as silky as Brandon Roy. Nobody, like Jalen Suggs moves very smooth playing basketball, which is very Roy-like. He's not quite Brandon Roy. Who are his comparables as far as NBA players?
I don't know. I don't look at the statistical comparables much anymore. They're not
really,
they're not of much value.
Who are some comparables that you can come up with aside from Roy and say the current NBA?
I mean, I don't know if there is anyone else quite like him in terms of, you know, point guards are either usually now outstanding shooters or explosive athletes, and he doesn't quite fit into either of those categories, but I still think he's going to be very good anyway.
Do you think he's going to be MVP candidate?
I wouldn't expect that. I mean, we talked about this on the Hoop Collective podcast today. We're running our top 25 under 25 on Tuesday on the NBA page. And like, he would be at the back end of that right now because there's just so much uncertainty about how players translate from college to the pro. So
is he near the top of that as far as non-NBA players?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's someone who's eligible for the 2022 draft, I think, who's putting up huge numbers in Europe, who I don't know a lot about yet. I've not quite gotten on my radar yet, but like he's, out of this year's draft, he's my favorite prospect. I don't know if he's the best prospect. There are, you know, five very good prospects. Obviously, you think Evan Mobley is the best because he's from a Southern California Pac-12 school. So, I think there's a world in which he could be should be considered the best of those five players.
All right.
So, well, continuing our toasts, congrats to Anna Wilson and Stanford on winning the program's first national championship and the first for any Pac-12 school since 1992.
Oh, wait, really?
Yeah.
After all the dominance in women's college basketball, they hadn't won a championship since 1992.
Yeah, I mean, that I started writing that note yesterday and was like thinking about it, and it was like, well, who would have won since Stanford? A bunch of teams have made it to the Final Four since then. Well, Oregon lost in the Final Four 2 years ago. Oregon was the prohibitive favorite, I think, to win last year's championship, but I don't know if you heard that they didn't play it. So it could have been back-to-back Pac-12
champs. Stanford's had very good teams in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, they lost in the title game twice in the 2000s and had been in the Final Four. I mean, it was Tara Vanderveer's 13th Final Four. So the Pac-12 has been in the mix, but just hasn't been able to get over the hump. So, but it was an all Pac-12 final on Sunday as they beat conference rival Arizona. A bummer for Adia Barnes and her team. It was an awesome run for Arizona, including an upset of UConn in the semifinals on Friday. That's going to go down as just a real memorable moment, including Adia Barnes's profanity in the post game huddle and flipping the bird. So quite a moment.
Did you not see that?
Yeah,
no.
This was quite a thing. People really rallied behind it.
So is Adia Barnes, she went to Arizona?
Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, so far in her career at Arizona, very, very short career as head coach.
This is her fourth season.
To be in the national championship game within 1 point of the national championship, a shot away, if it weren't for Anna Wilson, of the national championship. You have to think at this point that Adia Barnes is similar to these coaches that you're talking about, you know, at the very, very beginning of her career, but could be somebody who's a fixture of the deep NCAA tournament runs for decades to come.
Obviously, it's the challenge is to repeat this and to keep doing it. But that was something Tara Vanderveer mentioned in one of her press conferences, was like thinking back to where she was in 1990 when they first made the Final Four and projecting ahead 30 years and thinking that that would be 2051 and how impossibly far away that seems now. But that's been her reality. And, you know, it's been a while since Tara Vanderveer has won the title, despite, again, the consistent run of success. So as you mentioned, Wilson was the primary defender with more than a little help as UW transfer Ari McDonald missed the final shot Sunday.
UW transfer.
Yeah, she played with Kelsey Plum as a freshman. Adia recruited her here. And then when she didn't play for Adia because Adia had already taken the head coaching job at Arizona, Kelsey Plum's senior year and McDonald's freshman year. And after that year, McDonald transferred to Arizona.
Was there any chance of Adia Barnes being the head coach at UW?
I mean,
was Arizona just destined?
It didn't work out timing wise because Mike Nabors was still in position there when she took the Arizona job. If she would have had that choice, I don't know. It's a tough question. Like, she obviously loves Arizona, but yeah, it was funny. I was going back and rereading an interview I had done with her when I think she first took the UW assistant job in like 2012. And talking about how, you know, Seattle is home for her. And so it was exciting to be able to get a coaching job here. And you wonder, I mean, certainly if it had been open in the Arizona job had not been open, you would think Adia would be the UW coach today.
Wow.
Instead, we've got a new coach. We'll talk about that later in the pod as well. Congrats to Raj Joseph on winning our women's tournament challenge by correctly picking all seven games from the Elite Eight onward. Finishing number 145 among all ESPN entrants.
145?
145.
Wow.
I mean, if you can get into the triple digits, like, you're doing something. That's not far from the top 100.
Holy cow, Raj Joseph, that is incredible.
That's for believing in the Pac-12 and having the Arizona-Stanford final, which you had to check. You were hoping that you had gotten that, but you did not.
I should have trusted my gut. I should have. Well, that was the exciting thing about this championship game is you were able to slap on your Pac-12 hat and just everybody wins.
Rob Lowe was thrilled. All right, next up, to UW volleyball, which wrapped up the school's sixth Pac-12 championship with Saturday's straight set victory at Cal, finishing 17-3 in conference play. The Huskies earned the number 6 overall seed in the NCAA tournament, giving them a first round bye in this year's reduced 48-team field. All of those matches will be played at Omaha Convention Center and Arena starting April 14th.
Omaha. Do we still have Pelton Cast hats? Are we done? Are we done with those?
We are out of Pelton Cast hats.
We've got to re-up Pelton Cast hats. Maybe a different color. We should maybe re-up Pelton Cast hats, partially because I want one that is a different color for myself personally.
That makes sense. That checks out.
We should just look at the Tacoma Rainiers hats and just choose one.
The blue and red is quite popular. And lastly, as far as the toast, to Isaiah Thomas, who has made his return to the NBA with the New Orleans Pelicans on a 10-day contract. It's going to be interesting to see what happens going forward. The Pelicans are in an unusual spot because they're trying to avoid the luxury tax. After this contract ends for Isaiah Thomas, they can afford 22 more days of minimum salary total. There's 34 days left in the regular season when this ends. And they want to save probably at least one of those to sign a 15th player at some point. So there's going to be basically a break between 10-day contracts. So we'll see if Isaiah Thomas comes back for a second one. But either way, very exciting to see him back in the NBA.
Is the expectation that he's going to play, or is he going to be deep bench for them?
Well, they need anyone. It's all hands on deck because they have a lot of injuries. Unfortunately, they're mostly at forward. Lonzo Ball came back the other night. So now they are more set at point guard, where they also have Eric Bledsoe and Kyra Lewis, Junior, the rookie. But, you know, I'm sure that he's
his
going to get some
oxygen. Kyra Lewis' name?
Yes, it's Kyra.
Wow, had no idea.
Yeah, right. Many people don't.
Yeah, the more you know. We're just all about learning on the Pelton Cast.
Whoop now. We're going to learn a bit more.
Quickly before then, if we are able, we're going to actually talk about this. I'm going to force Kevin to talk about this. If we do re-up Pelton Cast hats here within the next couple of months, we will make sure to get one to you, Daniel and Raj.
Absolutely.
No guarantees, though. Do not hold us to that.
Do Don't really hold us to anything we say on this podcast, please. Especially Mariners hot takes. Anyways, with that, let's do some learning about the Seahawks offseason. Well, to help us break down Seahawks free agency, now that it's kind of winding down, we bring back an old friend and third Pelton brother who we remember fondly from his time covering the Seahawks as my colleague at ESPN, now at The Athletic, covering the entire NFL, including every notable free agent signing, handy out of grade this summer, as I well know, an ambitious task. Welcome back to the pod, Shield Kavadia. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. I feel like, Kevin, you and I, we should just really have off, off podcast phone calls about the process. You know, we can get Barnwell in there, just the process of grading these free agents. We were doing it before we started recording, but there are like very few, like if I talk about this with my wife, she doesn't care. Other people, they don't care. So there are very few people who can talk about the process and commiserate with me. So maybe next year we just do a podcast on that.
And no one ever asked. They just like react to the grade. They never want you to like explain the process of grading. No one has ever asked me that in all the time I've been doing trade grades. So that could be great fun.
But there you go. I'll ask you.
Yes. Today, instead, we're going to focus on the Seahawks. And as I said, you've been breaking down all these key moves, but that's kind of been individually move by move. And wanted to start out by talking holistically. If you were going to grade the entire Seahawks offseason to date, how would you grade it?
Oh, boy. I would probably give it around a C, probably. C minus. I think by the time the draft is over, it'll probably be a C minus, given that they only have three picks. But I think it's been okay. I don't think they had a ton of flexibility, obviously, to make moves. I didn't necessarily love the moves that they did make. I didn't think any of them were insane, where I was giving them an F, like an Andy Dalton or a Kenyon Drake. So it was kind of in the middle. You know, I think my big takeaway is just that it's a high floor team. I don't think they're going to be a disaster, but it's also hard to sort of paint that scenario where, hey, they're going to take this great leap next year and win the Super Bowl. I mean, as you know, that could happen in any year if you get good injury luck and a couple of young guys play well, but it's hard to just kind of paint that scenario right now as we sit here on April, whatever it is.
Do you know, and maybe this is not even within the realm of possibility for the Seahawks, but what would an A offseason have looked like given the cap situation that they went into the season with?
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. I think an A offseason would have looked like pretty much a complete investment in the offense. And just, I don't know, maybe, I mean, Kerry Hyder, like the way, I'm sure we'll talk about the individual deals, like low level deals like that, fine, absolutely. But basically, maybe not. I don't think the Chris Carson deal was like terrible, but you know, maybe investing some of that money into the offensive line, maybe investing some of that money at wide receiver, you know, a third wide receiver, another pass catching weapon, and then saying, hey, we're bringing in Shane Waldron, not just to run the Rams offense, but we're really going to put everything on the offense. Again, this is like fantasy land with Pete Carroll. So if this sounds crazy to people, I understand, but that would have been my big thing. And, you know, to make some of those moves and just try to kind of invest on that side of the ball, maximize your chances at having a top five offense, which they've had, and then sort of figure everything else out after that.
All right, as we drill down onto the individual moves, what was your favorite move the Seahawks made this offseason so far?
Yeah, I was just trying to pull up my grades for the moves that they made.
And, I do have those handy.
If you do? Okay, like, yeah.
So Carlos Dunlap there, that re-signing did get the best grade at an A, a B-plus for the Hyder deal, B for Gerald Everett, C-plus for Carson.
Okay, there you go. Thank you for the very what a prepared podcast host. That's outstanding. So I guess by that I've got to go with Dunlap, right? I think it would be Dunlap or Hyder. I mean, I thought the Dunlap deal was really good, and I sort of have. I don't know if that's a market inefficiency or what, but I always feel like teams can get value with the veteran pass rush market. Even now, there are guys out there. I don't think you have to run out on day one and pay a guy $16, $18, $20 million a year, because I do think those guys tend to develop later. I think they can play well into their 30s. And if you look at Dunlap's production really over the past three seasons. You know, he's certainly been a top 20 pass rusher. You can make the case that he's been a top 15 pass rusher. He's been unbelievably durable over his career. I mean, you know, the guy is always out there. And when you're looking at free agents, I feel like that's a big thing. You know, if you want to, especially with the Seahawks, you have a limited amount of resources. You can't invest in guys, just take a flyer on somebody with an injury history. And so when you look at the rest of that edge rusher market, you know, Shaq Barrett is up there around $17 million a year. Matt Judon is getting, you know, $14 million a year. Bud Dupree, $16 million. I mean, the list goes on. There were one, two, three, four, five, six, seven pass rushers or edge rushers who got between $13 and $17 million a year. And so when you look at that, and then you look at getting Dunlap for, what was it, 2 years, $16.6 million. I mean, to me, I would much rather do that than any of those other big name edge rush deals.
Yeah, and I think the structure of that deal, it looks even better now that we know about it than when we talked about this last week. So it's basically a one-year deal for right. $8.5 million guaranteed. And then a potential second year, which would be a $4.2 million essentially base. It's $4.025 million in base salary plus 175K roster bonus, and then up to $5.05 million in 2022 if they decide to keep him for that season. So, you know, that's as long as he stays reasonably healthy and productive, I think better than you were going to do for him next offseason.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. You spelled it out there. And then with Hyder, I mean, I think that's a good sort of gamble to take. You know, 2 years, $6.5 million. The guy had 8.5 sacks last year. And I don't think they're like the, you know, the cheap sacks. I mean, the film grinders love Kerry Hyder. Like, he's a technician. I mean, it's just been a case of sort of staying healthy and consistency, which I know I just talked about, but this is a very low cost deal. I mean, I thought a team was going to get a little bit more aggressive with him and sign him to a bigger deal. So, like, you know, those are two guys who could potentially combine. Like, would it be crazy for them to combine for like 16 sacks or something next year? And certainly, you know, you would expect them, I think, to at least get you like 10 or 11 if they're healthy. And so I think that was the nice addition. Whether he's a rotational guy, I don't know what percentage of the snaps he'll play, but I know he's someone who a lot of people like, so I like that move as well.
All right, down on the downside, I mean, Carson got the lowest grade. Is that the move you liked least, or is there one you didn't grade that maybe you'd liked less?
Yeah, that was probably the one. And, you know, to be honest, I didn't completely hate the Carson deal. I really like Carson as a player. I know you guys have had, I'm sure you've had the running back conversation a million times. And that, you know, I tend to lean towards that side also. And so if you're asking me if I was John Schneider, would I have done this deal? No, I probably would not have done this deal. I would have tried to get a running back in August on the league minimum for $1 million. I would have spent a sixth or seventh round pick on a guy that I liked. Like, you know, they got Chris Carson in the seventh round there. I was there when they drafted him. And so I would have gone that route, and I would have said, all right, let's spend that excess money somewhere else, whether it's another offensive lineman you're taking a flyer on, whether it's a wide receiver. They still have other holes on the roster. And so I feel like when you have a limited amount of resources, you've just got to be really smart about it and careful, and you're not going to be able to get every guy back. And so I wouldn't have done that deal with the Seahawks. Now, if I were like another, if Carson would have signed this deal with another team, I might've given it a better grade because it's not crazy. You know, it's not like he didn't go to like 8 million like Melvin Gordon did last year. And a lot of the advanced metrics on Carson are really good. I remember when I was putting together the free agency preview, you know, it really felt like he was maximizing the opportunities that he did have. You know, I like the way he runs. I like a lot of the things about him. I just feel like if you're Seattle, you know, I would have looked at resource allocation and probably not spent that money there.
Is that a question where, because hearing your overall grade and then hearing the individual grades are almost all stronger than your overall grade for the offseason. Is this almost like the whole is less than the sum of its parts type of situation? Or is there, when you only have so much money to spend, and again, I'm trying to be very positive here on the Seahawks, but is it just that the Seahawks have a bit of a value issue, which is like, yes, Kerry Hyder is good value. Yes, Carlos Dunlap is good value. But getting a good pass rusher is a less valuable thing to have than getting a good third wide receiver or getting a good offensive lineman.
Yeah, I think you laid it out well there, and you make a fair point. I'm going through these grades, and I didn't really crush them for anything. But and maybe some of it is the Russell Wilson stuff. We're looking ahead at just having three draft picks and looking at it all as a whole, and just kind of knowing what I fear, you know, Pete Carroll might be thinking with the offensive coordinator change and how they might be starting to play at the beginning of next season. And so I think the things that you mentioned are certainly fair, you know, like $8 million for Carlos Dunlap. So, you know, would you have rather spent the money there or on, you know, take your pick at of wide receiver like Juju Smith-Schuster, you know, which player would have more affected or impacted their ability to kind of reach their ceiling next year? You know, I'm not in like love with Smith-Schuster. There's probably a wide receiver I'm forgetting about, but I think certainly, and I don't know that he would have been a fit because Lockett plays the slot so well, but you guys know what I'm saying. You know, a player like that who could really affect the passing game for you offensively, I think you can certainly make the case that you could have done that. And then, you know, maybe you take a flyer on a pass rusher, see who's available in August. I mean, there's still a lot of guys out there. Clowney's out there. Melvin Ingram's out there. Ryan Kerrigan, like that veteran pass rusher market. There's still, it's probably the strongest area of free agency still available. So I think what you said is correct there that, you know, I don't know that I think the signings they made individually are mostly fine. I think when you look at it in terms of resource allocation, I don't know that it sort of changes their bottom line of who they are going into 2021.
The one major move that we haven't talked about was not a signing, but trading for Gabe Jackson and then extending him to be their one upgrade on the offensive line at left guard. How much do you think that he helps address that Russell Wilson concern?
Yeah, that might have been their worst move, but, you know, honestly, I mean, looking at it, just because I feel like what did they give up? A fifth round pick, mm-hmm. right? So you give up a fifth round pick and then you had to extend him and he's 30 years old. So, I mean, and for a guard, I mean, I don't know, like historically, I feel if that's a tackle, okay. If it's a guard, it better be somebody who is, you know, among the best in the NFL, which I don't think he is. You know, he played all 16 last year, but the previous 2 years, he missed, I think, 8 games there. And so I don't know. You know, I am talking out of both sides of my mouth here. I understand that, but I don't know. Typically guard is not a position where I say, all right, go ahead, give up draft capital when you only have so many picks and also extend that guy to a, you know, not a crazy deal, but certainly you're paying him more. Again, it's what, around $7 million a year, I think. Right. So I don't know that I think I probably would not have made that move for a 30 year old guard, but I don't know. Is that just appeasing Russell Wilson and saying, hey, we at least did something. We did one thing for you. And also, I mean, I don't know, like their offensive line last year was not worse than the offensive lines I covered there in 2015 and in 2016. And, you know, I don't want to say you go into it and say we can have a terrible offensive line. You don't want to do that. You want to build the offensive line. But at the same time, they've had, you know, top 6-7 DVOA offenses with offensive lines that were worse than last year. And so, you know, maybe it's just a matter of keeping that draft capital. Maybe it's a matter of addressing that in the draft, looking for more low cost options, whatever the case. But I did think that was a little bit of a stretch that I'm not sure I would have done.
One other move we haven't talked about is the decision to waive Jaron Reed to create some additional cap flexibility. What did you think of that? I know you're a big fan of his fit with the Chiefs when he landed there.
Yeah, and they could because, you know, and that was a lot about value. You know, I don't think I loved that deal for the Seahawks last offseason when they signed Jaron Reed because he had the one monster year as a pass rusher. And then I thought he was a solid starting defensive tackle, but I don't know that I would have paid him $10 million or more. And last year he has a pretty good year. So I might've been wrong. I thought it was, I mean, it was strange. I mean, there's no other way to put it than it was strange to kind of go about it the way you did, you know, releasing him the way you did, whether he didn't want to restructure his deal or take a pay cut and then using that money to assign Carlos Dunlap. So if we're looking at process, I think it was a bit puzzling. If we're looking at the end result, and if it was a matter of Dunlap or Reed, I think that's a, you know, I think it's a fine decision to go with Dunlap.
So the Seahawks probably aren't completely done, even though they don't clearly have a lot of money, depending how many other contracts get restructured. We saw the extension for Tyler Lockett that we haven't seen details on yet, but surely will bring down his cap number substantially in 2021. But, you know, if we're talking about like low cost options still on the market, are there anyone, is particularly a wide receiver, since you have mentioned that a few times as a place you would have targeted, is there someone still out there who could make sense for them as a low cost option?
Yeah, I'm looking at, you know, I did this list of the top 150 free agents, and the wide receiver, there aren't many wide receivers there. You know, there's basically two guys on here. One is Golden Tate, which I, you know, I don't think a reunion is happening there. And he's 33 years old and didn't really play well last year. You have Lockett in the slot. That probably doesn't make sense. I guess the wild card is Antonio Brown. You know, he I believe is still out there. If you're, you know, the off-field stuff is probably a whole different discussion. You know, I don't even know if he should be in the league, or if you're comfortable signing a player like that. If you're looking at it as just an on-field fit, he would be. I mean, he absolutely would be an on-field fit. I thought physically he looked better than I was anticipating last year. He had, I mean, 483 yards in 8 games with the Bucks, and that's without play, you know, without playing like starter level snaps. And so, you know, from a football fit, that would be really interesting. I mean, Antonio Brown, DK Metcalf, and Tyler Lockett, like argue, you know, that is one of the best wide receiver trios in the NFL. If you're going to make a move like that. Now, again, he's facing a lawsuit for alleged rape. So there are a lot, you know, a lot of things to factor in there. He obviously was short-lived in with the Raiders and then with the Patriots, and then he goes to Tampa for half the season. So I don't know that any other teams are even looking at him. I don't know from his standpoint. Do you just say, let's just go back to Tampa with Tom Brady? You know, it worked out last year. Let's do another one-year deal there. I don't know, but I guess you could kind of consider him as maybe a wild card for the Seahawks. I know Russell Wilson has been pretty public, right, in saying that he's a guy they should go after.
Yeah, that's definitely one where, I mean, again, we can make our own judgments about everything else with regards to Antonio Brown. But if you want to appease Russell Wilson, and this is something that they're looking to do, I would say that the Seahawks haven't been super consistent with regards to conversations around off the field stuff and players. It's definitely not something right where they've matter of fact blanket been like, this is not something we're going to engage with.
Yeah.
And Antonio Brown is somebody who would make Russell Wilson happy this offseason.
I mean, you said that they are looking to appease Russell Wilson. It's not clear that they are from everything they've done.
If they are,
yeah. I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that obviously it was not Seahawks not being there, but also seeing Antonio Brown score a touchdown in the Super Bowl. And immediately after that was Russell Wilson's kind of press offensive against the Seahawks. Don't think that was all a coincidence. So that's interesting. I mean, the other position we haven't talked about is cornerback, where they lost Shaquille Griffin, obviously, added Akello Witherspoon, is more of a low-cost flyer from the 49ers. There's another former 49ers cornerback who seems very available at this point. Seems like if you just call, I'm waiting by the phone, I'm here. Could you see a Richard Sherman reunion with the Seahawks?
I could. Yeah, no, I could see that. I don't, you know, I think when they played the Niners, I think Sherman made it. Yeah, I think he was on good terms with Pete Carroll, right? And, you know, if part of moving on from those guys was to sort of hand the team over to Russell Wilson, well, now it's sort of on shaky ground with Russell Wilson. So, like, do you really care about that much? I mean, he's already got his contract. He's a scheme fit. I mean, I will say from my time there, like, I haven't seen a veteran who was, like, with his position group, more well-liked or helping younger guys who, like, may not have even a chance in the league, like, working with those guys and giving them support and giving them tips. So I've always been a fan of Richard Sherman just from that perspective. And also as a player now, is it a risk? Obviously, you know, he barely played last year. He's going to be 33 years old. I will say, and you know, that deal worked out well for the Niners. I mean, he played really well for them in 18 and 19. So it's probably going to be a 1-year deal or a 2-year deal with some incentives in there. and he's still on the market now, so he's obviously not getting the deal that he envisioned. I don't think that would be a crazy move. I mean, who knows that defense? I mean, really, he would know it better than a lot of the coaches who would be able to help if you added some, you know, undrafted free agent cornerbacks who would be able to teach them that defense and the technique that they use with their outside corners better than Richard Sherman. And, you know, when I left there, I wasn't sure about his relationship with Russell Wilson, and that stuff has been well documented. But, you know, they seemed okay when those teams played each other. They did the jersey exchange, and they've been apart from each other for a while. And, I don't think that Sherman's going to care whether they're holding Wilson accountable in practice or not at this point in time. A lot has changed, basically, is what I'm saying, in the last 4 years. So I don't think that would be crazy. There are a lot of corners still out there. You know, Casey Hayward, I believe, is still out there. He's another guy in his 30s who is with the Chargers. Steven Nelson from the Steelers is probably going to be more expensive than I think the Seahawks would want to spend. Bashaud Breeland is a guy, he's more of a man corner, but he was a starter with the Chiefs. And of course, Quentin Dunbar, you know, you might be able to get him for a really cheap deal if you still feel the way about him that you did last offseason when you traded for him. So I do think they have kind of a number of options there.
When is the comp pick deadline? Do you know?
I think May 3rd. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right, so sign guys after that.
We have to wait until May 3rd for them to announce the Richard Sherman signing.
There you go.
I mean, if they're actually planning that far ahead, then kudos to the Seahawks front office. I have been underestimating you all along.
I mean, you remember when they waited out Ziggy Ansah for a very long time.
Among the many things that the Seahawks seem to kind of oscillate on all the time is whether they care about comp picks. And this year, it's been... the other guy who's still out there we haven't talked about yet is KJ Wright. And if Wright signs somewhere else, then they would stand to potentially gain a comp pick. As it is right now, they're not netting out any. So,
yeah, I mean, you guys know how well he played last year. Now, a player his age, obviously, you are going to expect some kind of decline at some point. But, I mean, he was fantastic last year. I was really surprised that another team that like had some cap space didn't sort of make a move for him. You know, I thought a team like the Packers, they've got nothing at linebacker. You know, they don't have a ton of cap space, but I thought like a veteran like that, who's a really good player, great teammate, great locker room presence, someone like that. I think I had them when I was just kind of projecting players and teams and fits. And so he's obviously not getting the deal that he thought he'd get. He's one of these guys who really got screwed with bad timing with free agency. You know, the last time he hit the market, it was like the 1 year he got injured. He's been incredibly durable other than that. And so, you know, he hits free agency then. He plays well the last 2 years, and then he hits free agency now. But, I mean, off-ball linebackers in their early 30s just typically don't get a huge deal. So we'll see what happens with him.
Yeah. All right. We definitely wanted to ask you about a conversation we had last week, which is if you're taking a look at the NFC West after these big moves at the quarterback position by the Rams trading for Matthew Stafford, the 49ers trading multiple first round picks to move up to number three to presumably draft a quarterback, that quarterback TBD, whether they play this year, TBD. How do you rank the four NFC West teams and their chances at winning the division this season?
Whew, that's a great question. Let me start with the bottom because that's easier. I think I would put the Cardinals at the bottom. You know, I do not like the offseason they had. I mean, they signed a bunch of old guys. The AJ Green deal, you know, I don't think I gave that an F, but I probably gave it a D. I mean, he was, if you look at any advanced stats, he was legitimately one of the worst starting wide receivers in the NFL last year. He's over 30. I don't know why you're paying him $6 million rather than taking a flyer on a younger guy. The JJ Watt deal, I mean, maybe that works out, but I mean, just think about what we talked about with Carlos Dunlap for $8 million or JJ Watt for $13-14 million. I think, or was it 15? I think it was $15.5 million a year for JJ Watt. Yeah, I think it was 2 years, $31 million. So like, to me, that's an easy decision. I would rather have Carlos Dunlap for $8 million. Watt played fine last year. The previous four seasons, he missed literally half the games. I mean, he was sidelined for 32 games. And so now a guy in his 30s, I don't like that. So, you know, their big thing, I thought this offseason, it wasn't so much about the personnel moves. I thought they had to figure out the offense with Cliff Kingsbury and what they wanted to do with Kyler Murray, because I was not impressed with what they did schematically. I don't think they're maximizing the talent on the roster, and I don't think they did a lot to add to the talent on the roster. So, you know, Kyler Murray throwing bombs to DeAndre Hopkins is really fun. I love watching it when it works. They probably have a high floor. I don't think they're going to be a disaster, but I also don't have confidence that they've sort of fixed what was their major issues, and that was get it maximizing efficiency on offense. I think they were 19th in DVOA last year. So I would put them last. All right. Third, I guess. Let's see. This is where it gets a little bit tougher. Can you tell me what who are the 49ers going to draft and what they're going to do? Because it's kind of crazy. It's crazy what they could do.
If I could tell you that I'm covering the wrong sport.
Okay. You know, I do like the 49ers roster a lot. Having said that, I mean, they've won six games or fewer in three or four seasons with Kyle Shanahan. You know, I like Kyle Shanahan. I think he's a really good offensive coach. I think he probably gets underrated in terms of culture and sort of that type of thing, because I do like the way those teams play. But man, if their plan is to draft Mac Jones or sit the rookie, you know, or sit a rookie and go with Garoppolo and see if he gets injured, I'm not really inspired by that plan. Now, if they, you know, they know quarterbacks better than I do, but I would be much more excited about them if they were like, we're getting rid of Garoppolo, we're drafting either Fields or Lance, and that guy's going to be the starter from week one. Then I would be like, okay, they really believe in this guy and the ceiling is really high on them. So I guess if you're asking me who will win more games next year, the 49ers, Seahawks, or Rams, it's like, do I want to gamble? Because the Seahawks floor is always so high that I have trouble putting them third here. I ain't got the Rams in there, man. I really should have spent more time thinking about this earlier. Now I'm just thinking about it on the fly.
We did send you this like a full 15 minutes before yeah. We started the podcast.
You know what? I'm going to put let me put the Rams there. I'll throw a little bit of a wild card. Okay. I think they have a high ceiling. Absolutely. There's no doubt. I think they're Super Bowl contenders. At the same time, they've got that, you know, I don't know if it's a Stars and Scrubs roster or whatever you want to call it, but I mean, what they're paying, I didn't love their deal with Leonard Floyd. I thought that was kind of crazy what they paid him to play defensive end. It's like, you know, you could put one of you out there next to Aaron Donald. You probably get at least six or seven sacks. I don't think you need to pay. You're both shaking your heads. I don't think you need to pay Leonard Floyd $16 million a year when you have other holes on your roster. So they're losing their defensive coordinator, Brandon Staley. You know, they lost some key players, John Johnson, Troy Hill. These were guys who played a lot of snaps for them last year. So I don't think the defense is going to be nearly as good. Now, when you still have Aaron Donald and Jalen Ramsey, you probably have a high floor. But, man, we saw one of those guys gets injured, and it really is a totally different team. I mean, that's a credit to them. They are that good. You know, sometimes we overrate defensive players. I think those guys are that good. But if you don't get great injury luck with those guys, I think you're in a tough spot. And Stafford's going to be an upgrade. But I just feel like the range of outcomes for them, the low end is lower than probably the Seahawks' low end is. So I'll put them third. Now I got to go with the top two.
Yeah.
I'm going to like change all these right after I name them. I'll put the Seahawks second and the Niners first. What the heck? I know what I just said about the Niners, but, you know, I thought the Niners this offseason basically needed to either take a big swing for a starting quarterback or address the backup spot. And so I guess they're kind of maybe addressing we don't know. They're kind of addressing the backup spot here. Potentially, if they're going to go with Garoppolo and also have a rookie on the roster. And so I just think they have a lot of pieces in place. I mean, whoever plays quarterback is really positioned to succeed with Deebo Samuel, George Kittle, Brandon Ayuk. You bring back Trent Williams, which I think was a gamble, but you know, their defense is not going to be as good, but I still think it'll be fine. So I don't know. I'm like already regretting this ranking, but I'll put them first and I'll put the Seahawks second. Again, I think the Seahawks floor is like, you know, 7 or 8 wins barring a Russell Wilson, you know, big injury there. I don't know what their ceiling is. You know, there's always a chance that you draft some guys and they come in and they play really well. You can never count on that. That's not the most likely outcome, but you know, who knows? If you hit on like two draft picks who are quality starters or above average starters, then
that requires you to have more than two draft picks.
Yeah, right. There'll be two of three. Yeah, most teams don't hit on 67% of their overall pick. So I think we're all expecting them to trade back, but I think, you know, the Seahawks would definitely be in that 2-3 range. And what the heck, I'm on a Seattle podcast, so I'll give them two. Well, how would you guys rank them? You guys have done this exercise?
I think this is a really fascinating question because any person could answer it completely differently with all four teams.
Yeah.
And I think that the division in general, there's no clear number one. I mean, to me, I just can't buy the Niners are probably going to go into the season with the worst quarterback in the NFC West. I think there's a very high likelihood that that's the case. And it's really tough for me to buy that they're not the favorite to be last in the NFC West, especially
they didn't have the best quarterback in the division when they went to the Super Bowl 2 years ago.
But still, even then, the roster is worse than it was two seasons ago. And
that's true.
See, so I'm so clearly that the Niners are behind everybody else, especially if, I mean, if they're starting a rookie quarterback, the expectation of them winning such a difficult division just seems like too high of an expectation. And Jimmy G just hasn't proven over that time period. I think beyond that with the other three teams, I know Kevin is very skeptical about the Cardinals. The Rams, to me, go into the year is probably the prohibitive favorite, but I think it's very close between them and the Seahawks.
Yeah, I have Rams, Seahawks, Niners, Cardinals.
Okay.
But then I actually did the math on my percentage chances of everyone but the Rams, it turned out the Cardinals were like 1% lower than the Rams, the Seahawks, and the 49ers. So this is why it's a fun question that we'll be continuing to debate, I think, right up until the start of the NFL season because of that. The other debate that we've had on this podcast that I wanted you to weigh in on from a national perspective, you mentioned the Bears critically panned move to sign Andy Dalton. That came only after they made some effort to trade for Russell Wilson, offering three first round picks and two starters, a third round pick and two starters they were about to waive. How many first round picks would it take for you to grade the Seahawks trading Russell Wilson, a B or an A?
So me grading them. And so Pete Carroll is still the head coach and John Schneider is still the GM, correct?
Yes, we're operating in this world, yes.
Okay, I do think it's important framing because, you know, yep. if you told me that like the Seahawks had a different, you know, let's say Pete Carroll retired, they had a different head coach and they were sort of just starting a rebuild. They felt like their roster wasn't great. They weren't sort of on the clock here. Then, you know, you could probably make some kind of case. I mean, I still don't think that I probably would do it, but you could make some kind of case that let's maximize the value for Russell Wilson. Let's rebuild. We'll take a flyer on a young, inexpensive quarterback. We'll maybe address it in the draft, whatever the case. But I just feel like given where they are and how much time they've had together and Pete Carroll's age, like, I mean, I don't know. Is there even a number you could put on it this offseason? Like, what would make him think let's go into next year without a top, whatever, 7-8 quarterback in the NFL and you're not getting a quarterback back in return? I mean, what could really make you want to do that? And so I guess it would have to be such a number where I could take a little bit of what I got back and trade for a quarterback who I thought was not, you know, was at least okay. And, you know, or get some draft capital. I wouldn't do it for three first round picks. I think five first round picks, I would probably, you know, we're definitely having a meeting and talking about it strongly. And I think maybe I would do that for five first round picks. I mean, that's a huge haul. You know, you can trade two first round picks. Maybe you're not competitive next year. You wait till next offseason and you say, hey, what quarterback's available? We can give up two first round picks for that quarterback. Maybe it's like the 10th best quarterback in the NFL, but now you've got three, you know, you've got multiple first round picks in three of the next five seasons. You can build a really good roster, So you can, I guess you can kind of talk yourself into it. Now, you know, I grew up a Sixers fan and was part of the, you know, one of my earliest sports memories is Charles Barkley for Andrew Lang, Tim Perry, and Jeff Hornacek. So I understand most of the time when you give up the star player, you're not going to be happy with the return and it's not going to work out. But, you know, given Russell Wilson's age, I guess you could say, if you told me 5 first-round picks, I would think about it. If he was 26, 27, I would probably still say no to that. But, you know, when you're talking about a guy in his 30s, and I know quarterbacks are playing longer, that's a discussion I would certainly have at least.
I mean, I didn't mention this last week on the pod, but I thought that the Niners trading up to 3 added context in favor of Tristan's argument that the number was huge because, you know, the Niners, for a quarterback who is not going to be a sure thing, although they will be on a rookie contract, give up, yes, it's 3 first-round picks, but also one of those first-round picks is, you know, number 12 overall. It's much better than that Chicago offer. Their pick, first-round pick, I think is 20th. So you're not even getting a premium pick that first year before Russell Wilson goes to the team. So that made me think that it definitely has to be 5 or more, you know, to even start having the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, the big question is, all right, what is our plan at quarterback? Right. So if you have one and you think, I mean, I don't know, you can name like a bunch of mediocre guys out there, Derek Carr, Teddy Bridgewater, whatever. If you're like, all right, we'll just kind of roll with that guy for a year and we don't have this short timetable. I mean, we only have 3 picks this year. You know, we're not really positioned to have a Super Bowl caliber roster. We'll hold on to our core guys, you know, the Tyler Lockett's and the DK Metcalf. But if there are guys who are in their 30s, I think you would almost have to like trade it out, you know, trade a lot of those guys. Like, all right, Dwayne, what can we get for Dwayne Brown right now? Or, you know, whatever other older players you have on the roster. I think the problem with the Seahawks is they don't have a great roster. They don't have a lot of those guys. And so you look at it and it's like, if you replaced Russell Wilson with like the 15th best quarterback next season, I mean, they're not making the playoffs. I don't, you know, they're not a good team. Like he is lifting a lot of the parts around him with the way that they're built. The defense is going to be mediocre and we all know what he does for the offense. And that's not even speaking to like the durability. I mean, the durability is probably like the most underrated aspect of his career. You know, like you don't have to worry about him missing games. And so if you have the 15th best quarterback, but it's a guy who might miss 4 games. Like it all adds up to a team that might win like 6 games next year. So there's certainly a lot of that to take into account.
We lived that life with Puth's 2006 Matt Hasselbeck.
Yeah, there you go. So I do wonder if they were like really serious about it, about trading him this offseason, which, you know, I'm sure they listened, but it didn't feel to me like there was going to be an offer, but man, that Bears organization, and I know you can only trade draft picks out 3 years, right? So that probably hurt them a little bit. Like, I don't think the Bears can even trade there. I don't know if there's a way around that or not. I don't think anyone's really tried, but my gosh, if ever there were a team to fleece, it certainly would have been the Bears this offseason, where I think there's probably literally nothing you could have asked for that they would have said no to.
Interesting. I didn't know that was the rule that you could only trade draft picks out 3 years.
I think it is. Yeah. I think it is something like that. Like you could only trade this off season up to 2024, I guess it would be, or maybe it was 2023. Again, maybe that's like there may be ways to write around that, you know, but I think just when you have it set in stone, I believe that's the rule.
Interesting. It makes a lot of sense. And I think that almost makes Russell Wilson untradeable if that's the case. I mean, you'd have to look at it and be like, it would have to be the entire Bears draft for 3 years, basically.
Ricky Williams offer times 3.
I think right. It would have to be. That was for a running back. But
I think the Bears would have said yes. I mean, really, they're like, they would have been like, we'll figure it out. Go ahead. It's all yours.
Yeah. I mean, Russell Wilson would have been by such a large margin, the greatest quarterback in modern Bears history that there's almost no price too high.
Yeah. It's a case we see in all sports when the coach and GM are just trying to sort of be competitive enough to save their jobs. like those are the teams you want to call a lot and see what, which of your players they are interested in. And I think they're like a, such a great example of that, given the way their offseason has gone.
Well, Sheil, we miss having the chance to read you every day on the Seahawks, but definitely enjoying having you on the national NFL beat at The Athletic and getting all that great coverage. Where else can people find your work?
Yeah, it's all there on The Athletic. We'll have stuff coming up here in the next few weeks, just doing a piece resetting the entire NFL offseason with one thing we've learned about every team. So I think that'll go up by the time people listen to this, and then it'll be draft coverage. And we'll figure it out after that. So you can check it out on The Athletic. We have an Eagles podcast, The Birds with Friends. And of course, then The Athletic football show with Robert Mays. I pop on there from time to time as well.
This is good because I think I remember the last time we had you on to preview a Seahawks or Eagles game. Birds with Friends had just started. And there were jokes on the pod the next day about how you failed to promote it when you came on the Pelton cast.
Yeah, let me mention their name. Bo Wolf and Zach Berman are the co-hosts. You know, very, very, very sensitive when I don't do that. So thank you for the reminder there. I won't get in trouble later this week when we record.
That's good to know. Thanks so much for doing this.
All right. Jim, thanks, guys.
Can I offer a take? I know everything good happens when I start that way.
Oh, no. Famous last words.
It's funny because Sheil gave the Seahawks offseason a C to a C minus. And it's funny because after that conversation, and as I've been thinking more about this, I'm feeling a little bit more positive about this particular Seahawks offseason.
Why is that?
Thanks for asking. I just feel like given the situation that the Seahawks have found themselves in, I think they have done the most in this particular offseason that they could have possibly done with it. You know, there were, I think a lot of what they're doing right now is undoing past mistakes, but you really kind of have to factor in Jamal Adams is a huge part of the Seahawks offseason. And when you say to yourself, where do we want to allocate resources? Maybe it's not safety in particular in the secondary, but you do, if you're going to invest on defense, you want to invest in the secondary. And somebody like Jamal Adams, who can kind of do everything, who could boost the pass rush and who can play in coverage. Might even like to see him play a little bit more in coverage. But it's a lot about undoing some of the contracts that they had in the past. It's about undoing the Rashad Penny pick and making it right. And not even saying, basically, like, it's sunk cost at this point. If Rashad Penny's not going to be your starting running back, you can't say we invested a first round pick in Rashad Penny and then just force him to be your running back. And I think given the circumstances, they've found players at important positions who seem like quality NFL players on affordable deals. And I feel like that's kind of the most you can ask. I'm a little bit surprised to hear Sheil's take about Gabe Jackson. I'm personally feeling more positive about Gabe Jackson. And I think that Gabe Jackson, I don't want to say this time next year, because we're going to be, the Seahawks have been eliminated for months at this point. But I think by midseason next year, we'll look like one of the best linemen on the team. I think we will be looking at that as, look, it'll be difficult for him to equal necessarily the contract, but I think we'll say that he's one of the anchoring pieces of the Seahawks offensive line, which is an important thing in trying to keep Russell Wilson around.
I feel like, to kind of the point you were digging down on with Sheil, part of his grade just kind of reflects the Jamal Adams trade and the hole it put them in terms of both draft picks and not necessarily cap space, because he's not taking up a huge amount of your cap at this point, but all of that in terms of having so many holes that you needed to fill in free agency. I mean, it does all kind of stem from the Jamal Adams trade.
But are there that many holes? That's the question for you. Is like, when you look at the Seahawks roster, when he's like, the Seahawks have a bad roster, and I'm like, I think we are underestimating the Seahawks roster a little bit. And you can't exactly parse out how important Russell Wilson is from everything else, because obviously Russell Wilson is important. But like, the roster is filled with superstar players, right? Jamal Adams, Bobby Wagner, DK Metcalf, Russell Wilson, right? Maybe there's no superstar player on the offensive line, but like, you'd put those up against pretty much any team star players with those, you know. At some points, Bobby Wagner has been up there with the best defensive players in the league. Jamal Adams is tough to pinpoint exactly what he is. At the very least, he's a very unique defensive player. DK Metcalf.
But we know what the defense was last year.
But what was the defense? That's the thing. It's like the defense was two different things. Post Carlos Dunlap, the defense was very different. And Carlos Dunlap is coming back. So it's tough to look at. And I don't know if I just look at this roster and say to myself, they lack talent. I'm not sure if that is an accurate way to describe the Seahawks roster. Again, you look at the wide receivers and your top two wide receivers, Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf, I think you'd put up against almost anybody in the league, right?
Sure. I think that this Seahawks team, look, they were an average defense last year. They were slightly better than average in rush offense. They were ninth in rush offense DVOA. But the reason this team was good last year was their passing offense. So yeah, Russell Wilson, Tyler Lockett, DK Metcalf, that's the core of the team,
but
without question.
If you pair, we talked about this all last year, if you pair an average defense, which I would probably anticipate from the talent that they have, with that offense, you've got yourself a Super Bowl contending team. The only thing that went awry for them last year was the coach stepping in and fixing the offense. I mean, that's kind of where everything went off. Like, if we're talking weeks 1 through 8 last year, this team was a fucking Super Bowl contender. If Pete Carroll doesn't meddle, what is the issue here? You're not saying this team lacks talent. It just, it lacks a particular sense.
It was that it lacks talent besides Russell Wilson. If you took Russell Wilson off the roster, shit ain't going to work. That was the argument. It was in the context of trading Russell Wilson. That was what it was in context of.
I understand that, but Russell Wilson is still like, if you take LeBron James off the Lakers, they lack talent, right?
But
if you take Michael Jordan off
the Lakers do lack talent. I don't know if you've seen their results lately. The conversation.
If you take Michael
you
Jordan off
of the Toon
squad, they lack talent. Look,
you seem to be taking
there.
This quote out of context, which the context was again why you shouldn't trade Russell Wilson.
Okay, great. Yes, don't trade Russell Wilson. I'm just saying in general. I think that we are judging too much of the Seahawks talent by the second half of the season and not enough of the season in whole. And I think that is, if you look at the season in whole, this is, I don't know where they finish in DVOA, but they still finish as a very good DVOA offense. And you should assume that they're probably not as good as they were in the first half and probably not as bad as they were in the first half. Can they be top 5 offense? Can they be a top 15 defense? That is a Super Bowl contending team right there.
I mean, sure.
I think we are underrating the Seahawks right now because of what we saw at the end of the year.
I think you're underestimating the issue that playing in the NFC West is, because it's going to be very difficult to win the NFC West given the number of teams that are in the mix. And if you don't win the division, you have no chance of making the Super Bowl realistically anymore.
But I mean, we talked about that. I think they have as good of a chance to win the division as anybody else.
But that's still not good enough, because the problem is, the Green Bay Packers don't have as good a chance to win the division as everyone else in the NFC North. They have an extremely good chance to win the division. The Bucks or Saints, whichever of those two wins the NFC South, has a good chance of being ahead of you in the standings.
Okay, so this I can probably agree with, which is because of the Seahawks' circumstances of who else is in their division, the chances of them earning the number one seed, which is dramatically increased in importance in the last year, is lower, even though a number one seed didn't win the Super Bowl, which has dramatically increased in importance as far as advancing the Super
Bowl. And a division winner didn't win the Super Bowl, did they? So it does undercut my argument I just made, doesn't it?
But it is still true that that's the case, right? And the number one seed in the AFC made the Super Bowl. Like, the Buccaneers are a unique circumstance, but because of the division that the Seahawks play in, even though they may have the talent and the roster of any team in the NFC, because of the competition within the division, you wouldn't say that any NFC West team is a prohibitive favorite to win the NFC.
Do you think the Seahawks' chances of winning the Super Bowl or winning the NFC West, let's maybe start there, are better than they were coming into the offseason? I think they're about the same.
Yeah, but also given the circumstances of where they weren't going to change that much. What happens with the Seahawks and their chances is going to depend a hell of a lot more on all the other teams. It really depends on how much of a Stafford guy you are or whatever, the progression that Kyler Murray makes. So I'm not sure if that's a thing that the Seahawks at this point could really control that much. When you're a team and you're in your fucking 10 of the dynasty or whatever, you just, you're
dynasty.
Not...
What dynasty is this?
But you understand what I'm saying.
You call it a run, that's fine. It's not a fucking dynasty.
When you're in your 10 of the run with a particular star quarterback, your flexibility is always going to be low. That's the reality of this. Teams don't go out. The Buccaneers were able to draft all of these great young defensive players and then add Tom Brady at 42 to that. That is a unique scenario. But when you look at the
Saints, do you think the Seahawks process is maximizing their chances of success with Russell Wilson?
I think just being in the mix is maximizing your chance of success with Russell Wilson.
I don't agree with that.
Do you think that the Packers have significantly increased their chances of winning the Super Bowl? The Falcons, the Saints? I mean, like, a lot of these teams with veteran quarterbacks, you kind of are what you are heading into the season. And the only chance that the Seahawks really had for this was maintaining those draft picks. So we're having to go back to August to really have this argument.
They also had the choice to not pay $5 million a year for their starting running back. Again, it could have been much worse, but that's because we're taking for granted that the Seahawks absolutely will spend massive resources on a position where we know that empirically it is not a good idea to spend resources on.
If Chris Carson walked, they would have spent that money on somebody who would have completely changed your perspective, this $5 million.
But again, you're operating within the constraints of knowing the Seahawks make bad decisions.
I'm not even saying knowing the Seahawks make bad decisions. I'm saying no team. How many teams out there during this offseason have, you think, fundamentally increased their chances of going to the Super Bowl? Maybe aside from the Stafford trade.
Yeah.
And that's it? That's every single team in the league?
But I don't know.
We could be talking about that Stafford trade.
You think that the Seahawks had an above average free agent offseason relative to everyone?
Every single offseason is bad. And talking about teams in terms of what they did.
It doesn't make any sense.
It's all. I don't believe that there are that many teams that have really altered their futures that much this offseason so far. We'll see post draft, but it really comes down to how much do you believe in Stafford? How much do you believe in Carson Wentz?
Okay.
And how healthy will J.J. Watt be? So, I don't know. I think that most teams are in basically the same situation as they were at the end of last year, save for maybe the Rams. And we'll see with the Niners, you know?
Well, that really makes an interesting offseason talking point.
I think we get too caught up in the idea of winning the offseason. I guess is what I'm saying. We judge too much about offseason.
No one's saying the Seahawks made a mistake by not going out and spending top dollar for the best free agents on the market. The question is, given the money they had, did they allocate it in the best possible way? And they did fine. They could have done much worse. They probably could have done better in a world where, again, they weren't operated like the Seahawks.
I'm still not hearing the answer for how they could have done much better.
I mean, they should have invested more in the offensive line. I mean, personally, I have come around to the idea that you should say defense does not matter. Invest almost nothing in defense and invest almost entirely in offense. And the Seahawks do not have that philosophy, as it turns out.
Let's not talk about the Seahawks for like 3 more weeks. Until they sign, sure.
Well, I don't know if you're aware of this. There is this draft coming up. The Seahawks are not going to be prominently part of it, but we are going to preview it.
Prominently have Zach Whitman on to talk about 3 players.
I don't know if Zach is following the draft as closely this year as
Zach. Some of us have had children and been at Seahawks games 3 days later.
Well, I can't dispute that. Should we talk about our search for Seattle's best fried chicken?
Absolutely.
So it took us this week to Marco Polo Bar and Grill in Georgetown, which is the longest running competitor, I'm certain, in our search for Seattle's best fried chicken. Opened since 1950 in the Georgetown neighborhood. And this is a place that I've driven by countless times in my life, including last Friday when I went to Costco to get gas and have never gone to. Despite its reputation for fried chicken. So it was someplace I was curious to check out in this competition. I still have not been there since I made you go pick it up.
You didn't make me go pick it up. I vowed to eat every single piece of chicken fresh. Thank you. And that's what I did. You couldn't stop me from picking it up. In fact, it was so hot when I got it. I actually intentionally chose to wait until I got to Jan's house to eat the chicken because I said to myself, this is too hot.
Wow. So Marco Polo specializes in broasted fried chicken, which involves frying chicken in a pressure cooker to speed up the process and seal out the oil.
Interesting.
Yeah, I learned that this week.
Okay. I didn't know what broasted meant.
I mean, I could make some assumptions, but I didn't know specifically, no, either.
I thought it was just when your bro roasted you.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Well, I think first and foremost, number one, did you know that you were sending me to a Kook bar?
I did not know that, no. It's on the website.
It's fine. Actually, I would say, I'm pretty sure there was on the sign out front that you said you've driven by, quote unquote, countless times. It said, quote, go Kooks.
I didn't say that I necessarily internalized it.
I think they have, it's maybe a Cougar Gold mac and cheese.
I don't know if I've ever had Cougar Gold cheese. It
honestly sounds great. I'm sure.
Yeah.
No, nobody's questioning the quality of Cougar cheese, but it honestly, like, without having gone in there, we've talked about watching sporting events there before and I just have never done it. Do you remember this? Yeah, we've talked about it, and just I don't know why I haven't chosen to do it, but I think as far as a sports bar, it would be a great place to go hang out and watch a game. You know, it's like, it's pretty unassuming. It's an easy place to, you know, if you're a suburban person, it's an easy place to go and park or whatever in the neighborhood to get to. It's huge. It has tons of TVs. They seemed very, very on whatever sporting events were happening. There was like multiple different soccer games on. It was pregame for the Final Four. I thought it was a pretty nice setup in there. I'm not surprised that they've been in business since 1950.
For sure.
What sporting events do you think they were showing in 1950?
All Seafair. A lot of Seafair.
There has to be a Pat O'Day autograph somewhere on one of those
walls. Oh, if there isn't.
All Seafair. the chicken, it's bar chicken. And I don't know if it's a real competitor beyond that. I thought it was good, but the chicken that we've had recently between Cookies, between Mangosteen, was the place D&E last week? Is that what it was called?
Yes.
Those chickens, I think they just added a little bit more in terms of flavor, especially with the fried. You know, like the flavoring on that D&E chicken was pretty incredible. The brine on the chicken also, and just like making the meat taste really good. And this didn't quite hit those elements for me.
I mean, it's interesting because clearly there are people that swear by this roasted fried chicken, like based on what we've seen online. And I thought that the level of crispiness was really strong, and, you know, you still managed to not overcook the inside of the chicken, which is, you know, striking that right balance there. But yeah, definitely the lack of full-on flavor and seasoning was a stark contrast to D&E from the week before, I would say.
D&E is a very flavorful chicken. Or like Bacabac, where it's the double fried chicken, so you get that really strong crunch. You know, it kind of didn't hit either of those, where I thought it was good. And if you were at the bar watching a game, I think it would be great to have. But it's something where I think that's what they specialize in more than they specialize in takeout chicken. You know, it's not even necessarily, it's just not what they're set up to do necessarily. So it's more of like, you're at the bar, you're watching a sporting event, and you're going to eat good fried chicken. Does that make it Seattle's best fried chicken? I'm not so sure about that.
Probably not. In fact, as we turn to our rating here, I rated it a 75.
That feels good.
Okay. You can go side on that one. Well, should we turn our attention back to sports? Because it's
okay,
time
so
for
the off season. No.
Oh, jeez. It's time for your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
I had to take a drink before this one because it's kind of a mouthful. Dateline, October 3rd, 1993. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. season one, episode three, Father Knows Less. Alan Matthews comes home late after disappointing his son, Corey, only to find that Curt Schilling, ace pitcher of his beloved Philadelphia Phillies, before he turned into a right-wing pundit, is pitching a no-hitter. He wakes Corey up, starting in the seventh inning, way after Corey's bedtime. Schilling finishes off the no-no, and a lifelong bond between the two is made. Then, what should happen? But 2 weeks later, the Phillies stunned the 104-win Braves to advance to their first World Series in a decade. Flash forward to April 1st, 2021, Renton, Washington, opening day. The Seattle Mariners have pulled off an improbable comeback to tie the San Francisco Giants. And as extra innings are about to start, with the clock pushing 11 p.m., Tristan Carcino calls upstairs to his eldest son, Luca, trying to sleep before a busy day of homeschool. Fraley's at the plate. Come and watch. He runs downstairs. Fraley walks, and the Mariners win. A lifelong bond between the two is made. Destiny is calling me. You cannot overstate the similarities between these two situations. That night, I became Alan Matthews. And the Mariners became the favorites to win the pennant.
Is it the second time this episode of Boy Meets World has been referenced on the podcast?
It was a very formative episode for me.
Yeah, you definitely made quite an impression on you. Not as much on me.
Pretty sure the Jim Abbott episode of Mrs. Fantasy Genius has something to say about this. What? Oh, you can hear your eye roll? What? She's not a Taylor Trammell fan, apparently.
Trammell. That's one thing we learned Trammell? Watching that game. It's Taylor Trammell.
Wow. He will always be Taylor Trammell to me.
Another reason he is not related to Alan Trammell. So many reasons he is not related to Alan Trammell. Well, the Mariners took, including that thrilling comeback.
Wow. Mrs. Fantasy Genius did not like those takes.
Wow. On opening night, the Mariners took 2 of 3 in their opening series from the San Francisco Giants. Coming back from a 5-0 deficit on the opener, entering the bottom of the seventh to win 8-7 on that walk-off walk you mentioned. Then in Saturday's season series finale, I suppose it's season finale. It's not moving much too fast. Chris Flexen went 5 innings in the 4-0 shutout win in his first MLB start since August 2019. Sadly, did not go as well for the Mariners tonight, as they lost 6-0 to the White Sox in the opener of that series, dropping them to 500 on the season. One thing we did not get to last week, I don't know if this was official yet at the time we recorded, but Kyle Lewis started the season on the injured list due to a bone bruise in his right knee. Sounds like it's going to be a couple weeks before we see last year's Rookie of the Year.
Mm-hmm. And the Mariners' top prospect is in purgatory right now.
Just counting down those.
Contract purgatory. What is the day they can call him up? June 1st?
I don't know. I'd have to look that up.
I hate baseball.
It's not the best. On the Sounders front, after an extended delay in the green card process, Raul Ruidíaz has finally returned to Seattle and will be able to begin training early this week. Securing that green card means Ruidíaz will not take up an international spot for the Sounders, giving them additional flexibility in adding to their roster this summer. Sounders' scheduled preseason match Sunday against Phoenix Rising FC of the USL was canceled due to COVID-19 concerns on the Rising roster. Instead, the Sounders played an inter-squad match, which saw Freddie Montero net a hat trick playing against reserves.
There we go.
And then Monday, the Sounders announced approval by King County Health Authorities of their plan to host 7,000 fans at Lumen Field for their first 5 matches, starting with the season opener on April 16th and going through the end of May, although that's still contingent on King County staying in phase 3 of the reopening process in Washington State rather than moving back to phase 2. So Sounders and everyone else hoping those case counts plateau, level off here, and then quickly drop after a bit of a rise in the last couple of weeks here.
Well, and also I think we should say that as your authority on health information in King County and Washington State, the Pelton Cast, that the vaccine appointments will be open to everybody 16 plus starting on April 15th. So we hope that everybody out there who has not been vaccinated already makes an appointment as soon as they possibly can, starting on that April 15th date, because there could be a Peltoncast Live in September, depending
on. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Make it so. Make it so. Look, if that's not enough cause to get you to take the vaccine, I don't know what is. Mm-hmm. Let's move ahead to UW sports. Husky softball. The Huskies swept a four-game series against Cal by a combined 27-8 score, including an 8-0 run-ruled win on Thursday. Gabby Plain won all three of her appearances in that series, running her record this season to 17-0. Huskies headed to Corvallis this weekend. Bees 4-9 so far against Pac-12 foes, with three of those four wins coming against the aforementioned Bears. Oregon State also beat Oregon once in their four-game series last weekend. As we mentioned earlier in the show, UW women's basketball has a new head coach. They announced on Monday that Rice head coach Tina Langley will be the replacement for Jody Wynn. Langley took over at Rice in 2015, a decade after the Owls' last NCAA tournament appearance, and with the program really struggling, improved to conference above 500 in Conference USA by her third season and returned to the NCAA tournament in 2019. Wow. After posting a 16-0 conference record. The Owls won the regular season title each of the last 2 years as well, and won the conference tournament in 2020. Unable, of course, to play in the NCAA tournament that year because it was not did not take place, but then lost, were upset in the final of the conference tournament this year. They went on to win the WNIT, emerging out of the Fort Worth Regional and winning their final two games over Delaware and Ole Miss in Collierville, Tennessee. So it's a national championship coach that the Huskies have hired. Rice has been led by 6'9" center Nancy Mulkey, a transfer from Oklahoma, who won Conference USA Defensive Player of the Year all three seasons at Rice and was named MVP of the WNIT. Before going to Rice, Langley was the associate head coach at Maryland under longtime head coach there, Brenda Fries. Notably, Houston is the farthest west she'd played or coached. So this is going to be a pretty big departure for Langley. It's not one of the West Coast candidates we talked about when this job first came open. UW definitely willing to spend on this hire. Langley will make $4+ million over the next 6 years per the Seattle Times, and go to a $650,000 salary in 2021-22. That is double what Jody Wynn was making this season, $325,000.
Wow. And the players are getting paid a good portion of that as well, right?
Yes, percentage-wise. Of course. Yes. Mm-hmm. They're getting that weight room with they got upgraded weight rooms after they shamed the NCAA on social media.
That was the exact thought that I had at the end of that game when Mark Few turned to Mick Cronin and was just like, "What are you going to do?" And they shook hands kind of knowingly, and they were like, "Ah, it feels great to not pay the players." It was just like such a like, you're one of the highest paid state employees in your state. I'm one of the highest paid employees in my state. Thank you.
Mark Few is not a state employee. I guess private school.
I guess, yeah, that's the one good thing about it. Not for the players, of course. There's nothing good about it.
So it'll be interesting to see how this works out. Obviously, Langley has not recruited on the West Coast, so it's going to be a bit of a departure for her. But if you look at the most successful outside hire that the Huskies have made with the women's basketball program in modern history, it was Kevin McGuff, who came in from Xavier with no ties to the West Coast or the Northwest, and very quickly was able to, you know, get a strong recruiting base that eventually formed the core of the team that his assistant and replacement, Mike Neighbors, took to the Final Four in 2016. So, you know, it's certainly not something that precludes you from success.
Yeah. There's about as much of a correlation between those two things as there is between the Boy Meets World episode and me calling Luca to watch a baseball game, but
I would say there's slightly more than that. By the way, did we skip Coach's Corner or Parents' Corner?
Oh, my God. Wow. Okay, maybe we should come to that back to that. I don't know, but what I will say is that it doesn't, like you said, it doesn't preclude you from success. Knowing the territory, if you're a good coach, you can be a good coach anywhere, and I strongly believe that.
And maybe hopefully she'll be able to expand her recruiting base outside of just Houston.
And I think that's the issue that I think we've had, well, maybe we'll talk about this in a second, with Mike Hopkins, which is that it doesn't seem like he's been able to really lock down the Pacific Northwest. It's not that nobody could do it, right? There are coaches who could and have been outsiders who've been able to recruit in the Northwest. It's more just that he's been much more comfortable recruiting elsewhere.
Yeah. Okay, should we?
And if he had time, he might build a base. You know, you have to build contacts with an area, within an area. Time. I mean, I was looking at fucking Scott Drew. Is that the coach? Larry Drew? Whatever.
It's not Larry Drew now.
Uh-huh.
Larry Drew, former Bucks coach. Besides Bryce and Scott?
Yeah, Bryce.
There might be another one. I don't. Those are the ones who were Division I head coaches.
I was
shocked. Homer Drew is his dad, their dad.
How long he's been the head coach of Baylor. And there must have been down years in there.
I mean, he took over a program that, you know, we don't need to go into it, but it was in shambles when he got there, in both on and off the court, in really a horrendous situation. So it took some time.
He's been the head coach for 18 years and they finally won a championship.
Yeah, I mean, they got to the NCAA tournament in his fourth year there.
And have
or
they
fifth year.
But have they, it just makes me think that I think those ties to the area are an important factor and something to build up. And I think that colleges in the interest, and maybe it's punditry or whatever, I think that colleges are a little bit too fast to move on from coaches who don't make sense and give them time. And maybe this is even a bit of a less of an indictment on Mike Hopkins. Maybe he needs more time. He hasn't been the head coach of UW that long. And look, he's not going to be fired this year, but maybe he just needs more time to build up those connections within the region. It's not something that happens instantly. And sometimes if you have the right coach who can coach the players on the court, everything else will fall into place eventually, provided they're trying.
I mean, the other concern about it, though, is then whether, you know, if you don't have ties to the West Coast, is UW going to be your destination school? Because Kevin McGough did reestablish the Huskies, but then he left and went to Iowa State. And Mike Nabors left and went back to Arkansas to coach there. So that's the other aspect of not hiring a local coach.
So if you're saying that, let's say things go great for Mike Hopkins, he's the head coach of Syracuse.
That's quite plausible.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, should we do Coach's Corner now?
Oh, my God. Oh, Lord.
We posted this on Instagram, and if you're not following at PeltonCast on Instagram, you missed out.
There was, basically the only time this year, Baby Fantasy Genius and Babyest Fantasy Genius had baseball practice at the same time, at the same place, which you think would be great, but Baby Fantasy Genius Babyest Fantasy, whatever the hell his name is, went so hard during warmups. He was running around manically, running is like run to there, which is like 20 feet away, and he runs like 60 feet away, just like constant, just going. He was stretching and stretching and stretching, and then he was supposed to be rolling the ball to his teammate across from him, fielding grounders, and then about 2 minutes later, he was laying in the dirt, fully laying in the infield dirt, face down, just like he was not having any more of that. And he went on to throw a Lou Piniella-style tantrum at this practice, like 10 minutes in. He picked up a base and threw it. He threw his hat on the ground. He kicked dirt around everywhere. Nobody was really paying attention to him. That's the only difference between Lou Piniella. It was because when you're 4 years old, you could just do whatever the fuck you want. Nobody really cares. But I can tell you that we were very embarrassed as his parents. And he has vowed to never once return to the baseball field.
Oh, wow.
He is done with baseball.
Wow.
Today I asked him, I was like, do you want to go play baseball on Sunday? He was like, no. So anyway, the Ender Dragon, it was just like, he didn't give thought to it. It wasn't like, it wasn't a thing he was considering. It was just like, no, he is not playing baseball. And also he's still playing Minecraft.
Of course. But
then we went today, middle fantasy genius, whatever the fuck his name is.
Baby,
you're a fantasy genius. He had baseball practice. Look, they're all in goddamn baseball. Over spring break, he had baseball practice. Took the wrong glove And so all I loaded up the other two. Baby is fantasy genius running around. Can I just call them by their names? Jesus Christ.
It's up to you.
Mateo is running around like crazy at the Marcos baseball practice. And he was like, this is great. I'm just going to run around the entire time. He like went in with the expectation to. He did. I will say I coaxed him into doing an at bat on Saturday at his practice. I was like, just hit. He went in line, tried to cut in front of everybody. Oh God, it was terrible. And he was like, it's my turn now. And I'm like, no, he doesn't know what a single file line is. He literally cannot tell that there are people ahead of him in line. And then so he hit the ball and then immediately ran away. He didn't run to first base. That was it. He hit that ball one time and he was done with baseball forever. It was like me with the soccer situation. He was just like, I'm done. I'm going to run to the car crying. And that's it. But so at Marco's practice today, me and Luca were playing catch, which I feel like he's gotten better at catch, right? We were playing long catch with each other, which he refuses to acknowledge that he's gotten better. I was like, have you noticed that you've gotten better in the last few weeks? And he was like, no, because children are great. And I look over and Marco is on third base and he picks up the base and throws it against the chain link fence. Why are my children throwing bases so much?
Have they seen you throw stuff in the house? Are they modeling here?
I'm pretty calm when it comes to at least being at baseball practice. I'm not, I don't know. I'm not picking up bases in the house and throwing them. It's like they know what my sports career was like and are trying to emulate that. But they weren't there in 2007 or whatever.
It's genetic.
I think it might be.
Well,
stirring shit up in semi-organized profession or semi-organized sports is just like it's in the Carcino blood.
Fortunately, they haven't had the shoulder pop out, which is also in the Carcino
blood. Oh my God. I saw Kispert today and I was like, I know exactly what happened to you. I saw it all happen when he was like holding his shoulder. And I was like, been there. Right? That's probably what happened to him. He like got like reached around really hard. It looked like his shoulder popped out for 1 second. He was fine eventually, but I saw it. Anyway, so 2/3 of my children threw bases at baseball practice this week.
Checks out.
Oh my God. No, I'm not going to say it.
Oh, wow. It's that bad? No one's listening at this point.
Luke is the slowest Carcino to have ever existed. I'm not going to say we're a fast bunch, but I'm pretty fast and agile. And it's very weird.
Self-described as agile.
So is Mrs. Fantasy Genius, right? She's fairly fast. I think she ran on the track team in high school at Eastside Catholic, which is now a freaking feeder to UW. But track, I assume. But it's very strange to me how he could be so slow. And I was just like, after practice, I was telling her, I was like, he's built like John Kruk. Like, he's just like golden age of 90s baseball out there.
I would not say that.
You don't think so? You should see him run. I swear to God, he would fit in 1992 in baseball. Like the analogy between that Phillies game and him today, it extends in other ways. Oh my God.
So coach's corner. There you go. All right, back to you to have a couple more notes.
Also, the last thought that I had was it was so hard for me not to yell at the kids' instructions while I was there. I was like, there's something I just like. There was a kid who I had no idea who the hell he is, but he was playing first base. And I'm like, keep your foot on the base. Stop coming off of the base when the ball is being thrown to you. Whatever. Don't worry about catching the ball. Worry about keeping your goddamn foot on the base. But I refrained. I have no idea who this child is. And nobody asked me to coach. So
it's definitely not coach's corner this year.
We'll see what happens. Look, it's only a matter of time. Maybe if I start yelling at the kid to keep his foot on first, they'll ask me to be the coach.
Or maybe they'll ask you to leave.
Oh, man.
Well, we've got some exciting notification of transfer news coming.
Oh, God. You've eliminated the transfer portal.
We're not using it anymore. All right. I'm done with it entirely. because I saw that I think it was Christian Cable retweeted Brandon McKinney, a player named McKinney who was on the who played safety for the Huskies.
He's gone.
That was already previously announced. That's not in the notes, but he posted the actual email, and it just says the player's information is available in the transfer portal. The actual title of it is notification of transfer. So that's what we're using from now on.
Wow.
We're taking a stand here on the Pelton cast.
Well, note that when it was messed up, I sang Sarah McLachlan. I will remember you to the term transfer portal, entering the transfer portal.
You're still going to see a lot of it outside of the Pelton cast, I'm afraid.
Just not here.
So Hamir Wright has submitted his notification of transfer. The first recruit from Mike Hopkins from upstate New York. Both of those are true. Played 4 years at UW, but apparently plans to use his fifth year of eligibility elsewhere, which all players are, you know, have available if they were part of this pandemic season.
Noted at one point that Seattle's home, I'll be here forever, and then took the head coaching job at Ithaca College.
You know, football front, wide receivers Austin Osborne and Marquise Spiker both submitted notification of transfer. A pair of four-star recruits in the 2018 class, neither managed to consistently get on the field at UW. Spiker had three catches, is a redshirt freshman in 2019, and none in 2020, when he did not dress for multiple games, evidently due to injury. While Osborne had one catch for minus 2 yards in 2019 and none in 2020. The timing does leave the Huskies light on scholarship wide receivers for spring practice. They're adding transfer Jalen Polk to the mix this spring. Texas Tech?
All right. I think that's right. That sounds right.
And freshman Jabez Tanai to a returning scholarship. You won't be part of spring practice.
He's coming in early with Sam Heward, but
he's not, no. Okay. To returning scholarships wide receivers, Terrell Bynum, Taj Davis, Jalen McMillan, Roma Dunze, and Sawyer Racanelli. I guess the good news here is the Huskies have not typically used a very deep rotation at wide receiver. That's part of why Osborne and Spiker didn't get on the field very much. And especially because they're likely to use multiple tight end sets a lot with Cade Otten as a primary receiving threat. Huskies also announced that 10 UW spring practices starting Saturday and concluding with the May 1st spring game will be open to fans who must RSVP for seating locations on GoHuskies.com in order to attend. And then lastly, one note we didn't get to earlier with the Seahawks. This happened after we talked to Shiel. Quentin Dunbar signed a one-year deal with Detroit, so he is not, in fact, an option for the Seahawks at cornerback.
It's all right. May 3rd or whatever.
The countdown is on to Sherm. 4 weeks away.
Mark your calendars.
No.
You know they're signing him. Come on.
I don't know that they're signing him. I hope they're signing him.
Especially with Witherspoon, too, who he knows. It's just like...
It seems like DJ Reed was also in San Francisco.
Yeah, that Sherm's coming here. Come on.
We'll see.
It's just it's an A+ offseason if they sign Sherm. He's also a good player.
No, it would be a good outcome. Obviously, I would endorse him.
It's kind of wild that Sherm hasn't signed with a team just as a flyer, considering I'm assuming he's not looking for a ton of money here. But is he still representing himself or does he have an agent?
He is still representing himself, yes. So
I feel like there's value to be had there for Richard Sherman. And either way, we talked a few weeks ago about how the offseason has been very fun. That's all you have to do. Sign Richard Sherman. Boom.
It would be very fun. Offseason. I agree.
We'll delete the Richard Sherman leaving podcast from a couple of years ago.
Oh, look.
It'll
those
be
emotions
from the internet.
Those emotions back happened.
He'll reblock all of those 49ers fans that he had blocked.
Yes. Yes, Seahawks fans can donate for him to block the 49ers fans. Well, on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.